court's intention is to keep you in jail till the end of your life.
A judge sentences a Bethel man convicted of child sexual abuse to 66 years. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 22nd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, coming to terms with the senseless death of a cyclist in South Anchorage.
You got to get on that bike and keep pedaling, because we know Jeff would, and he'd want us to keep riding.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
Former Bethel foster parent Peter Tony will spend the rest of his life in prison. Today, Tony was sentenced to 66 years with no possibility for parole for three consolidated child sex abuse counts in which he pleaded guilty. KYUK's Ben Matheson has more.
Superior Court Judge Douglas Blankenship sentenced the 70-year-old in a 2.5-hour hearing with a few victims and families in the room. After Tony did not completely understand the complicated proceedings, Blankenship put it simply for him and the courtroom.
You're a predator and too dangerous to society. So what the court's intention is to keep you in jail till the end of your life.
In a February deal with prosecutors, Tony pleaded guilty to charges of sexually abusing a minor in 2012 when he abused a 4-year-old his wife had in daycare. He also pleaded guilty to molesting a 12-year-old girl in 1998. Tony's stepdaughter, Kimberly Bruch, says she was abused by Tony as a child and spoke to the court, saying she hoped other victims would be validated by the sentence. Afterwards, she said she's found closure and added that the length of the sentence doesn't make a difference to her.
It's not going to bring my sisters back.
Bruch's two sisters were abused by Tony and later committed suicide. In considering Tony's sentence, the judge silently read through one sister's suicide note that mentioned the abuse. But Tony isn't going to jail for the abuse decades ago, but for more recent cases. The court says Tony had been abusing since the early 70s. No one knows exactly how many victims, but Tony admitted to a few. Stepdaughter Bruch says state agencies bear a large part of the blame and says she first reported in 1982.
There's agencies that could have perhaps helped him or held him accountable sooner. Maybe there would have been that possibility of rehabilitation 30, 40 years ago had they done their job. But not only did they fail to take action based on the reports that they received, they licensed him as a foster parent. They continued to ignore one report after another and continued to entrust more children to him.
Before running a small daycare out of their home, Tony and his late wife Marilyn had been foster parents for 14 years between 1984 and 1998, at which point they lost their license from the state after a substantiated claim, according to the Alaska Dispatch. There was no report to police at that time. To the knowledge of Corporal Amy Davis with the Bethel Police Department, she began investigating in early 2013. The 66-year sentence is longer than the 50 years the state actually asked for. Prosecutor Chris Carpinetti said the prospect of rehabilitation for Tony simply did not exist. Public defender Mark Osterman asked for a smaller sentence.
I think under the circumstances, Mr. Tony is redeemable, and I don't think that the court should throw away the key.
In handcuffs and a yellow jumpsuit, Tony made a brief statement saying he grew up without a father and with no guidance. He said drinking had caught up with him and he was never good in social situations. He apologized after being prompted by his attorney.
To those, I am really very sorry. I can't. There's no words that could really say what I, not to my knowledge anyways, that I am really, I wouldn't say that really I am sorry. Those things happen.
Tony was sentenced to 2 36-year prison terms with 6 years suspended and 10 years with 4 years suspended and another for a total of 66 years to be served. He also got at least 15 years probation, which the judge said is not going to be relevant at Tony's age. Prosecution indicated that it will be seeking restitution for victims. In Bethel, I'm Ben Matheson.
With the primary election a month away, fundraising totals are out for all candidates for state government races. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez joins us to talk about the numbers. Hi, Alexandra.
Hey, Lori.
So, Alexandra, let's start big. How did the candidates for governor do?
Well, all three candidates, that's incumbent Governor Sean Parnell, Democratic candidate Byron Mallott, and independent candidate Bill Walker, all kind of raised in the same band of spending. Mallott actually did the best this period, which ran through February, raising nearly $300,000. Parnell came right behind him with $286,000, and then Walker raised about $260,000. Of course, that said, Parnell, because he's already been raising money for so long, is well ahead of any of them. He still has about almost $500,000 left in the bank, where Walker and especially Mallott have spent a lot of the money they've raised. Mallott has had to do a decent amount of self-financing, putting $50,000 of his own money towards the race. And Walker's had to do even more. He's put $170,000 of his own cash up front, basically. But going into November, it's going to be a tricky situation for Mallott, it looks like, especially because he's only got $66,000 left about. That's not a lot of money when you're facing an incumbent governor who has nearly $500,000 left. And the way he spent his money is also kind of interesting. Looking at his expenditures, it looks like he's got a pretty big campaign operation, lots of staff, lots of money spent on offices. He spent $50,000 on polling, but there's been very, very little money spent on things that increase name recognition. Parnell, of course, he's kind of, you know, sitting pretty as the incumbent with a boatload of cash, and he's spent his money, it seems, fairly conservatively on the campaign, and he also just doesn't have to spend as much to be known.
Alexandra, there's also a competitive Democratic primary for lieutenant governor this year. How does the number two spot fit into things?
Well, I think that's especially interesting, especially when you look at the governor's fundraising numbers. Parnell is basically going to be paired with Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan unless some sort of miracle happens. And so right now, Mayor Sullivan isn't spending any more money on the campaign so much because he doesn't have to. He's got a competitor, but very little known. So he'll bring $15,000 to the Parnell campaign. Now, if you look at the Democratic race for lieutenant governor, you have two candidates. You have Hollis French, an Anchorage senator who's been in the legislature for a dozen years and run for governor before and is well known in the party. And then you have Bob Williams, a teacher who's from the MATSU and a first-time candidate. So Bob Williams has run kind of this upstart campaign, and he's raised a lot more money than expected, but he's also had to spend that money to be known. So where French raised over $60,000 in the same period, William raised about $30,000, but French hasn't had to spend that money so much. So Williams would only have about $13,000 to bring to the Mallott campaign if he pulled off an upset, where French actually has more money in the bank than Mallott does at this point. French has about $70,000 to carry over to Mallott's $66,000.
Are we seeing anything interesting in the legislative races?
Well, with the legislative races, the people who raised the most money this period tended to actually be these Democratic upstarts, the winner in fundraising this period was Claire Ross, who is running for state Senate against Mia Costello, who's already been serving in the legislature as a representative for half of that district. She raised about $62,000, more than any other candidate. And then right behind her was Harry Crawford, who is a former Democratic legislator who's challenging Kathy Giesel. He raised $50,000. And then you have Lori Hummel, who is a new candidate who is challenging Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, and she raised about $47,000. And so all of these numbers look really impressive if you take them on their own. But if you look at how much money the people they're challenging have already raised, all of these candidates are still behind. So, you know, take Claire Ross, for instance. Even if she was the top fundraiser this cycle, Mia Costello still has, you know, almost three times as much money left over because she's an incumbent. She's been able to fundraise for longer. She's been known longer. People have already given her money. And that's the case with all of these people.
Alexandra, thanks for crunching the numbers for us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, dip netting on the Kenai River for salmon and for fun.
The whole experience of just being on the beach, the water, the people, the sun, well, when it's out, it's just a really neat experience.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by Crowley, fueling Alaska for more than 60 years with a full range of residential, commercial, aviation, and marine fuel products. Crowley also fuels community events, from summer fun runs to public radio. More at CrowleyFuels.com.
Canadian investors are putting millions of new dollars into mining projects near the southeast Alaska border. They include the KSM and Tulsacua Chief prospects, which critics say could damage regional fisheries. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports on the status of several projects near watersheds draining into southeast and nearby rivers.
Welcome to Seabridge Gold's KSM project, a proposed gold, copper, silver, and molybdenum mine located in northwestern British Columbia.
A promotional YouTube video tells the story of the Kerr Sulphuritz Mitchell prospect. It's a group of ore bodies about 20 miles from the Alaska border and around 150 miles northeast of Ketchikan.
Our world-class team has conducted years of exploratory drilling, scientific research, and technical fieldwork.
That effort continues this summer and next, thanks in part to a group of Canadian financial firms. They're in the process of purchasing 1 million shares of Seabridge Gold, the KSM's parent company, and they could buy even more. That could bring the total new investment to around $15 million. That's not a lot for a large mine, so Seabridge, headquartered in Toronto, is negotiating with other potential partners to attract much larger investments.
All I'll say is that we continue to seek partners and we have confidentiality agreements with several.
Brent Murphy is Vice President of Environmental Affairs for Seabridge Gold. In an interview at a Vancouver, British Columbia PR firm, he said the company has drilling rigs on site right now.
We currently have about 35 to 40 people in camp, and the drilling program will continue until the end of September.
Seabridge has numerous regulatory steps to complete, but officials say the more than $5 billion project could be built and ready for operation within 5 or 6 years. Another near-border project is within a few months of completion. The Red Chris mine is already stockpiling copper and gold ore. The project, about 125 miles east of Juneau, is completing its on-site buildings, mill, and tailings storage system. It's near the upper watershed of the Stikine River, which empties into the ocean near Petersburg and Wrangell. Officials at its owner, Vancouver-based Imperial Metals, did not respond to repeated interview requests, but Imperial's website says the $530 million project is expected to open within a few months. Another project in the Stikine watershed is the Galore Creek copper-gold mine. Development has been suspended, so co-owner NovaGold can focus on its Donlin Creek project in western Alaska. But Communications Vice President Melanie Hennessy says exploration continues. During an interview in her Vancouver office, she said the corporation is reviewing drilling and other work conducted during the past two summers.
It involves quite a bit of work, quite a bit of technical work on modeling, and so it's more desktop work than it is physical on-site work.
Identifying more ore would allow NovaGold and co-owner Tech Resources, also Vancouver-based, to find new investors or a buyer. Another near-border project is the Tulsacua Chief Mine, which Chieftain Metals is trying to reopen. It's on a tributary of the Taku River, which ends near Juneau. Toronto-based Chieftain recently announced it had acquired a nearly $20 million loan to look for ways to lower construction and operational costs. Those in other mines have raised numerous concerns with Southeast Alaska environmental, fisheries, and tribal organizations.
It's going to create a lot of acid-generating waste rock.
Guy Archibald is Mining and Clean Water Program Manager for the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council. He says that acidic water can disrupt transboundary rivers and those nearby.
It could have very significant impacts, you know, starting with the fisheries, and that leads to problems with the economy, which leads to issues in the small communities, you know, whether they can continue to maintain their populations.
Several other mine projects are being explored or developed in the near border region. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting from Vancouver and Juneau.
Three bicyclists have been killed by vehicles in Anchorage this year. The most recent was 51-year-old Jeff Dusenberry, who was hit by a pickup truck in South Anchorage on Saturday. Fellow cyclists are mourning his death and waiting for the outcome of the district attorney's investigation. KSKA's Ann Hillman reports.
Three men sit on a grassy knoll above a pile of flowers marking the spot where their friend was killed just 2 days before. They chat about Jeff Dusenberry's kindness. He was always willing to fix a kid's bike. They talk about his passion for the sport.
I got a call today from a friend of Jeff's who said he was worried that no one's going to want to ride with him anymore because Jeff was always the one who called him to go for the ride.
That's Peter Van Toon. As he speaks, three boys bike past.
They're just having fun on a summer afternoon biking 3 miles an hour down this road. And, you know, Jeff was the safest cyclist, I think it's fair to say, guys, that we knew. I mean, he was always safety conscious, helmet, aware, you know, and these kids are just doing what kids do. And if the same thing had happened here, you're talking three kids. I mean, there's no distinction between Jeff and that. It's a tough thing.
On Saturday morning, Dusenberry was biking to meet Van Toon for a long ride. Decked out in his bright pink and blue gear and his helmet, he pedaled toward a short dirt path at the dead end of 84th Avenue. At the same time, a 17-year-old girl backed a pickup truck down the street, struck Dusenberry, and fled the scene. Police are still investigating the incident and say it could take up to 6 more weeks while they wait for toxicology reports and collect evidence. Then it's up to the district attorney's office to decide if the driver will be charged. Clint Campion with the Anchorage DA says fatalities from bicycle vehicle collisions are investigated in the same way as other traffic collisions. They collect information on how the vehicle was moving, if the people involved were impaired, and their histories.
Normally, we're analyzing whether someone acted recklessly or with criminal negligence, and if we believe that they did, then that's going to rise to the level of a criminal offense. If someone was simply negligent and doesn't rise to the level of a criminal offense, then we may not charge them.
Campion can't talk about the inquiry into Dusenberry's death, but he says sometimes investigations take months, which can be very hard on people who are grieving. The death of another cyclist killed on Northern Lights in January is still under investigation. Campion says it's too soon to say if charges will be brought in either case. Back at the memorial site, Darren Marin reflects on the lessons of his friend's death for both cyclists and drivers.
Everybody needs to just slow down. Just slow down and don't be in a rush and be aware of where you are and what you're doing.
But Mike Vanya says the tragedy won't stop them from biking.
You got to get on that bike and keep pedaling because we know Jeff would, you know. If it happened to one of us, he'd be torn up, but we know he would ride, and he'd want us to keep riding.
Absolutely.
About 700 cyclists die in vehicle collisions each year in the United States. That's about 2% of all vehicle-related fatalities. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by Raven Alaska, navigating Alaska's challenging terrain, serving more than 100 communities statewide. Details at raven.com. Raven Alaska, soaring above.
Denali climbing season has ended, and the numbers are not impressive. this year had the lowest summit percentage in more than 25 years. A number of factors played into the lack of summits. KTNA's Philip Manning has been reporting on Denali throughout the summer and has this final report on climbing season.
The last of just over 1,200 climbers have come off of Denali, and the results of this year's climbing season are not nearly as impressive as 2013's. After last year's record-setting climbing season, this year's 36% summit rate looks incredibly low. It wasn't a great year for summits. The 2014 season had the lowest summit success rate since 1987, and mountaineering ranger Joseph McBrayer says that much of the reason comes down to a tale of two weather patterns.
Last year we had amazing weather from about early mid-season to the end of the season, really warm temperatures and not a lot of moisture moving through the mountain. This year is opposite. We had a lot of precip and a lot of smaller to larger weather events. Really slowed things down.
Joseph McBrayer is part of the team of park rangers and volunteers who spend their summers patrolling the Alaska Range. Part of what they do is assist climbers who find themselves in trouble due to illness or injury. McBrayer says that cooler temperatures meant that the patrols were dealing with more frostbite than usual.
We were seeing frostbite later in the season than we normally do, which, you know, when you look at the spreadsheet on summit percentage rate and what type of injuries we see, it just runs the gambit every year. It's just different. So
okay.
It's hard to say there's ever a trend, but it was strange to see frostbite in July.
The weather may not be the only explanation for the low summit rate, however. Talkeetna resident Willie Pretty has been guiding on Denali for two decades, and he says that an increasing number of climbers don't seem to fully understand the magnitude of an expedition up the continent's tallest mountain.
We seem to be getting more and more people that believe they're prepared, and somehow they think they can go and do one mountaineering course and a couple of piddly small little climbs someplace, and somehow that makes them prepared and ready to do something as big of a challenge as Denali.
Willie Pretty says it's important for climbers who want to attempt Denali to take at least one course, as well as get experience on glaciated routes that require a serious commitment in order to be adequately prepared, but that it seems it's not happening as much as it used to.
In this really fast-paced modern world that we've all created for ourselves, everyone wants to go from step 7 to step 27 and skip everything in between. And sometimes people get away with it, and sometimes they don't.
Even with adverse conditions, most people did get away with it. Willie Pretty says that poor weather kept many teams from making a summit attempt at all. This year's lone climbing death occurred high on the mountain in an area known as the Autobahn. The accident occurred early in the season, before the frequent snowfall began. At the time, the route high on the mountain was compacted and icy. Pretty says that the deeper snow's arrival meant trading one hazard for another high on the mountain this year.
You exchange a lot of difficult icy conditions or very deep snow conditions, which can be technically less challenging. Of course, at some point, and many of the later season expeditions had to deal with this, is they never even attempted the summit because at some point you get enough snow that then you have avalanche conditions to worry about.
Now that the season has ended, the atmosphere has begun to change in Talkeetna. There are no longer as many brightly colored jackets or raccoon tans in town as there were in June, and the number of languages spoken on Main Street has taken a sharp decline. Still, the town, the rangers, and the guides all know that, barring something unforeseen, more than 1,000 people will be back next year to make an attempt on Denali. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Dip netters from across the state are crowding onto the north and south beaches at the mouth of the Kenai River, hoping to fill coolers with sockeye salmon. APRN's Annie Fite was on her own salmon mission last week and brought back this story with her fish.
Chad Preston is standing chest deep in frigid ocean water. He's fighting a swift current as he holds onto his dip net. Preston's been in the water all day, and he's not smiling.
Well, I'm trying. So far, I only caught one fish, and I'm disappointed right now.
Preston at least has one thing going for him. The water is not as crowded as it usually is. Most people are waiting out the slow period on the beach. Novena Richest is sitting in the breezy sun with a group of friends. She opens up her cooler to show off the 7 fish she's caught so far. The biggest one is resting on top.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. That's a beautiful fish.
It is, actually, the top one. That was my last one.
Riches started dip netting 10 years ago to feed her family. Now she does it for another reason, because she loves it.
It's when that fish hit that net and you pull it out, it's a special feeling that no one can describe.
Try to describe it.
It just makes you feel so good that, you know, yes, I got it. It's just so excited. I just love fishing. That's something that I love. Fun.
The crowds on the Kenai are not for everyone. When the fishing is hot, dip netters are standing shoulder to shoulder in the water. Walking on the beach requires stepping over nets, sleds, and other gear. But it's not hard to find people who love the carnival-like scene, like Monica Workman.
This is truly the Alaskan experience. And, you know, we own a boat, and people think we're crazy because they're like, why don't you just take your boat out? And we're like, no way, because this is the whole experience of just being on the beach, the water, the people, the sun, well, when it's out. And it's just a really neat experience.
Workman is dip netting with her husband and 2 kids. She says they all have a job to do. Her husband catches the fish, her son bonks them, her daughter slices the gills, and Workman guts them. This is their 5th year dip netting. Year 1, she says, things were not quite so streamlined.
We didn't even pack water. We had a little net. My husband had hip waders. I mean, not hip waders, but yeah, hip waders, the ones that come up here. And I didn't have a knife, a cooler, nothing. We're like, well, let's just see what it's like. And people are so nice out here. There was a lady who lent me everything. She gave me a knife. She told me how to gut it and everything.
Now the workmans are the experts, passing their knowledge along to their friend Robert Carter, who's in his 70s, but dip netting for the first time. It hasn't been an easy initiation. Carter has patiently held his net in the water for most of the day without catching a single fish. And then, finally, success.
Hold up before you lose it.
He drags the net onto the beach to inspect his catch.
He's a monster.
He's tangled up.
He's huge.
Carter holds his dip net in one hand and his fish in the other and poses for a celebratory picture.
I want a fancy picture.
That's right.
Ah, happy fisherman. Oh, it's unbelievable.
And with that, Carter is back in the water, going for that second fish. On the Kenai Beach, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Bethel, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ann Hillman in Anchorage, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Craig Taylor Equipment Company, an authorized dealer for over 15 manufacturers, including John Deere and Bobcat, celebrating 60 years of business in Alaska. More at CraigTaylorEquipment.com. And by Spinard Builder Supply. For more than 60 years, SBS has helped Alaskans build, from ground to roof to everything in between. Spinard Builder Supply is here to build with you. Attention, Alaska gardeners. Invasive weeds are a threat to landscaping, lawns, and gardens. They can spread and harm Alaska wildlife and waterways. Potted plants, hay, gravel, and soil, even clothing and vehicles can transport invasive plants to Alaska. So learn more at alaskainvasives.org. Let's protect Alaska together. Visit alaskainvasives.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Agriculture and the U.S. Forest Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.